Straits brings legal and business insights at the intersection of the shipping and energy sectors. This podcast series offers trends, developments, challenges, and topics of interest from Reed Smith litigation, regulatory, and finance lawyers across our network of global offices. If you have any questions about the topics discussed on this podcast, please do contact our speakers.
Welcome back to Trading Straits. Thank you for joining this podcast exploring the risks of incorporating new technologies in superyachts, particularly decarbonizing technologies. I'm Philip Reimer, a specialist shipping lawyer in the transportation group at Reed Smith. I'm joined by my colleagues Romain Farnu, a specialist in ship finance and transactions, and Thor Malouf, a disputes lawyer specializing in shipping. Romain, we're reading more and more about the use of new and experimental technologies to reduce carbon emissions in shipping. Is this something that has a place in yachting? What kind of innovations are we seeing in superyacht design in order to reduce carbon emissions?
Well, hi, Philip, and thanks for the introduction. Yes, we are seeing a lot of measures being incorporated into new designs, and I would include the following. Improved propeller design, we see a lot of hull optimization. Mostly we see reductions in noise and vibrations. For example, FedShip's project 710, where the design incorporates contra-rotating thrusters for drive and steering. They're replacing traditional drive shafts and rudders in order to maximize efficiency and minimize vibration. We see a lot of hybrid vessels with a transition in propulsion systems from diesel to methanol. Occasionally, we've seen reusing waste heat generation, which means to repurpose heat from the custom variable speed generators and air conditioner chiller for various applications, including pool water heating and engine preheating. Heat pumps allowing yachts to draw heat from seawater. And finally, electric propulsion with high-efficiency batteries with longer range. So, Tor, in terms of allocation of risk for all of these innovative designs, do they need to be considered in the shipbuilding contract stage? And what would be the typical situation for design risk?
Yes, thanks, Romain. The usual situation under yacht building contract will be that design risk will be borne by the builder. But having said that, it's normal to see an express term covering this situation. If there's no clear express term, the builder's basic commitment to manufacture the yacht will usually imply an obligation to ensure that the design will permit the yacht both to operate safely and also to meet any performance criteria that have been specified in the contract. And also that the yacht will be built in accordance with the detailed technical specification that's usually annexed to the contract. So to that extent, design, it's like one aspect of the workmanship that has to be fulfilled by the builder when they're building the yacht. So performance criteria agreed between the buyer and the builder, like specific carbon emissions limits, are very important. But if a yacht is going to be designed and developed by the buyer of the yacht, so not the builder, or by a third party, so particularly if it's got novel elements like you've just described, some of those new technologies, then it might not be implied into the sale and building contract that the builder takes the risks of those designs. So where we're talking about new and innovative technologies, there's going to be some uncertainty as to whether the construction, and even in line with the technical specification, will definitely result in a yacht that meets any performance criteria that have been warranted in the contract. It does need to be thought about and set out clearly in the contract where there are those kinds of design risks. Sometimes a yacht builder might refuse to provide a warranty or an assurance that a particular part of a very innovative design will definitely meet some operational requirements and warranties that the buyer might want it to. the builder might limit their obligations to just complying with the technical drawings and plans that they've been given for the particular design. And in that sense, then the risk will be on the buyer for what results from following that particular design.
So would you say that the fact that the builder agrees certain specifications about the yacht's performance changes the contract position on design risk? I'm thinking that if a yard agrees a yacht will be able to travel at a number of knots for a number of hours on electric power for up to 2 years, for example.
Yeah, so in most shipbuilding contracts, it's going to be the shipyard, the builder's responsibility to use reasonable skill and care to design a ship that will meet any agreed specifications. There can be disputes about design liability where the ship complies with a given technical specification, but nevertheless then still fails to meet any agreed performance criteria. So as you say, if the contract requires a yacht to travel X knots for X hours, what if it can't do that if it's been built according to a design that the builder of the yard has been provided with and complies with that specification? Well, there is case law on this in English law. In English law, whether or not the builder's compliance with the agreed technical specification sort of in effect trumps a right to receive a ship capable of achieving the warranted performance criteria was considered in a case, Hogard against UK Robin Rigg. And that was a case that went in the UK all the way up to the Supreme Court. The English courts tend to take the position that just because a construction project has been done in line with its agreed technical specifications, that will not excuse a later failure to comply with any agreed performance criteria. And that rule has been followed even where something was built in line with its specifications, and quite rightly so, but the actual specification that was provided would never have enabled the project being built to perform in accordance with its performance criteria. So in the Robin Rigg case, the actual technical specification itself was flawed, and it would never have allowed the actual project to be built in compliance with its warranted performance criteria. The actual case itself, the Robin Rigg, was about the structural failure of wind turbines. They failed within 2 years of installation in the Solway Firth in Scotland, so a very stormy and windy environment. The case went all the way from the Technology and Construction Court in London through the Court of Appeal and all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was on just this issue. It had been agreed between the buyer and the contractor that there would be compliance with a specification. And that was that the design had to be in accordance with a certain specification called J101. And it also been agreed that the turbines would comply with performance criteria, specifically that the design would ensure a lifetime of 20 years. So specification J101 and performance criteria, a lifetime of 20 years. So it obviously didn't comply with the lifetime criteria. And the contractor argued it shouldn't be liable because it had exercised reasonable care and skill and it had complied exactly with the specifications. The courts agreed the contractor had complied with the specifications and had exercised reasonable care and skill. But in this case, the compliance with the technical specification just simply didn't result in something that complied with the performance criteria. And the performance criteria in this case prevailed and took priority over compliance with the specification. And so the contractor in that case was found liable for a failure to meet the performance warranty. And in sort of weighing up its decisions, the Supreme Court said that where you've got two contract provisions that impose different and inconsistent standards, generally the more rigorous and demanding standard prevails over the less rigorous. So in this case, the rigorous requirement to have a 20-year lifespan took priority over the requirement to comply with the technical specification. But also, where a contract requires compliance with a specified design and specific performance criteria, where the performance criteria can't be achieved by complying with the design, then the performance criteria prevail. So that will generally be the case where the customer has specified or approved a design and the contractor will bear the risk. So in terms of the takeaway points, it looks like the courts are treating performance criteria as being the more paramount thing and the more important point to comply with. So buyers will need to make sure they set out any yacht performance criteria very clearly in the contract, together with some liquidated damages provisions and rights to reject delivery in case of non-compliance. And the builders themselves just need to be aware that where the contract requires compliance with certain standards and specifications, then just complying those with those will probably not excuse a separate failure to meet their warranted performance criteria. So if the yard needs a technical specification or a particular industry standard that has followed in building a yacht to be paramount and to be the last word, they need to make sure that is absolutely clear in the contract.
Thanks, Thor. That's very interesting. From my view, on a practical level, the buyer's starting point should always be that the builder's responsible for all design elements. Well, there can be arguments as to who's caused a particular defect and thus who's responsible. With innovation, then, for particular components, there may have to be specific arrangements around design risk and responsibility. As we've said, the drafting should be very clear as to the scope of the buyer's design responsibility for particular items. It may make sense that there's an agreed development and testing and trials program for particular items to be followed by the builder, in conjunction with the buyer and the relevant supplier. These intended to identify and resolve any design or related performance issues as early as possible and to minimise the possibility of the finished yacht having faulty design and unsatisfactory performance. So, you know, even for items where the buyer has some design risk, there's still builder responsibility. Then, in relation to intellectual property, this may require particular attention for innovation, where it's being supplied by the buyer or indeed by the builder, for example, with regard to its future and repeated use. The position may reflect what both the builder and the buyer have contributed in relation to the product and design development and its potential future value.
Yeah, that's right. And is the inherent risk of trying out a new design something that you also expect to see reflected in financing arrangements for super yachts?
Well, the present position in relation to superyacht financing is that there are still quite limited options for the financing of large yachts. It's available from only a small number of lenders, and they tend to lend on a private wealth and relationship basis and take a cautious approach, which I think will be even more cautious now where there have been issues with relation to sanctioned borrowers, for example. At the same time, we've seen there's pressure on lenders, or lenders prefer to fund yachts to meet environmental concerns and to be seen to be green. And different lenders will have their own general commitments in this regard. And yeah, we're all thinking, are yachts really environmentally friendly? So lenders are likely to focus on greener projects and those which incorporate specifications and innovation in that regard. At the same time, lenders are going to have a limited appetite for design risk, in particular where this is linked to future asset value. So lenders will look at each project very closely, and the lending and the level of lending will reflect the lender's evaluation of a yacht's design and its green status. I think that could mean that the availability of pre-delivery finance is going to be very limited.
And to add on to that, I would say that ultimately the new design component in itself should only have limited impact on the availability of financing in itself, as in super yacht financing, lenders will usually rely on either corporate or personal guarantees. They'll have a specific security package, especially on insurance proceeds, which would include hull and machinery. And as such, in case there is a defect in the design of the vessel, the risk for a prospective lender can be mitigated by structuring the financing adequately from a legal perspective.
Thanks, Roman. Thor, I was wondering, what's the position if there's an issue with the yacht after delivery? How does it work under the warranty the buyer has from the builder?
Yeah, so a yard or a builder will typically provide this warranty covering the vessel, machinery and equipment, so including any kind of new and novel aspects of the design, for 12 months from delivery and acceptance and the warranty period. If a defect does occur during or become apparent during the warranty period, then the builder will be obliged typically to rectify that at its own cost. And the contract will sometimes provide that some of the incidental expenses of actually getting to the shipyard for repairs will be covered by the yard as well. But if there are like a loss of use by the owner of the yacht arising from the defect, that is typically not recoverable under the building contract. So that's something to be aware of. So where there are increasingly orders for yachts that incorporate some new and innovative designs to do with decarbonisation, for example, which have not been tested, then the scope for these kinds of warranty claims and issues to arise is only going to be increased. So there are some points that yacht buyers need to be aware of. Firstly, those time limits, I've mentioned it's typically 12 months, they're really strictly enforced by the courts. So warranty claims need to be brought promptly. And where there are sort of bureaucratic formalities that need to be complied with to bring a warranty claim written in the contract, those really do need to be complied with. In order to head off any warranty claims, anything becoming an issue after delivery, buyers can make sure they actually monitor the construction and make sure that the key performance criteria under the contract are actually tested during the sea trials of the yacht. So, you know, during construction and test after delivery. That way you make sure that any issues that are going to arise are identified well within your usually 12-month warranty period.
Thanks, Thor. Absolutely. And of course, the points we've made before in relation to design risk and responsibility apply here also. The buyer may not get an across-the-board warranty in relation to all design issues. I mean, one possibility is that maybe different warranty periods for different items, including new technology items. There could be a provision for a post-delivery and acceptance trials and testing regime for certain items. Maybe the buyer might require a holdback on payment to pass of the contract price pending proving in performance of certain technology items after delivery. And also there might be some bespoke maintenance regimes for some of the new technology items which are managed by specific suppliers rather than the builder itself.
Right. Sounds like one way we could, maybe the best way to reduce carbon emissions from yachting would be to go back to a really already tried and tested technology, the age of sail. Have you seen any sign of increasing demands for sailing yachts, maybe in your sale and purchase work? Are we going to return to that golden age of sail?
What we've seen in recent years, well, for some years, is dwindling interest in large sailing yacht construction. And on the basis of that, we've seen some shipyards fail, like Perini Navi, for example. However, the market for large sailing yachts has seen a resurgence recently, and there may be some fit here with environmental concerns of owners and buyers. But I do wonder, however, whether the new and future generations of super yacht owners are true sailors.
Well, with all the new technology that's available, like self-trimming sails monitored by cameras, they may not need to be sailors. But then I guess that brings us all the way back to these new and innovative technologies that need to be integrated.
And to add on to that, obviously sailing, full sailing boats are yachts. Full sailing yachts is going to be one of the options, but that's probably not, you know, the only approach. We see a lot of hybrid energetic mix experiences that will help reduce one's yacht's carbon emissions. If you take, for example, the latest standard that has been launched by a luxury cruise company, Ponant, for a carbon neutral cruise ship, they are putting forward an innovative mix of sail propulsion, solar panels, bio LNG, and green hydrogen. So that's very much something to look forward to.
Thanks, Romain. Well, thank you for joining our podcast today, exploring the risks of incorporating new technologies, particularly decarbonizing technologies in super yachts.
Trading Straits is a Reed Smith production. Our producer is Ali McArdle. For more information about Reed Smith's energy and natural resources or transportation practices, please email tradingstraits@reedsmith.com. You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google, Stitcher, and reedsmith.com, and our social media accounts at reedsmithllp on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter.
This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship, nor is it intended to suggest or establish standards of care applicable to particular lawyers in any given situation. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome. Any views, opinions, or comments made by any external guest speaker are not to be attributed to Reed Smith LLP or its individual lawyers. All rights reserved.